Sacraments are what you do in church. What you do at home is something else. Cooking and sewing and running the Bissell sweeper and eating and sleeping and praying and scrubbing yourself are not sacraments. When you are little and ugly, somebody carries you into church on a pillow and you come out a child of God and an inheritor of the kingdom of heaven. They pour water on your head, and that's a sacrament. When you are 12, you walk back in yourself with your best dress and shoes on and your new prayer book your mother buys you, and you walk up to the bishop and he stands up and you kneel down and he mashes on your head and you are an Episcopal. Then you increase in spirit and everybody kisses you, and that's a sacrament. I left out the bread and wine. That's a sacrament too. I tasted some of the bread in the choir room. It tasted like my goldfish wafers. Then when you are married, you go back to church, dressed up like you were never were in all your days, and somebody sings, "Oh, Promise Me," and your sweetheart is waiting up by the minister if he doesn't forget to come, and you get a new shiny gold band on your finger and leave town. And that's a sacrament. Then you get carried back into church again, but you are dead, and it takes six people to lift you, and everybody cries, and that's the last sacrament you are going to get. One day, we got tired of playing hopscotch and skin the cat, so Edna Briggs said, "Let's play baptizing." And I said to Mrs. Williams, "May we play baptizing in your rain barrel?" And she said to me, "Yes, indeed," and went on tatting. So I put on my father's hunting breeches, I got Judge Williams' hat off the moose horn rack, and I dressed up like the Baptist preacher. And Edna ran to get all the kids, and I said to them, "The Lord is in his holy temple. Keep silent and shut up." And then I said, "All you sinners, come forward and hence." And nobody came but little Melvin Dawson. He is just 2 years old, poor little Melvin. He is so unlucky. I got him by the back of his diaper, and I dipped him in the rain barrel. Once for the Father and once for the Son. But when it came time for the Holy Ghost, poor little Melvin's safety pin broke, and he dropped to the bottom of the rain barrel. Everybody ran, and nobody would help me, and I had to turn the rain barrel over to get him out, and I galloped him on his stomach on my pony to get the water out of him, and then I sat him inside his house, and I went to Mrs. Harris' house, and I got under her bed. And when she looked under there and saw me all soaking wet, Mrs. Harris said, "Rain and hail in Beulah Land, what has happened now?" And when I told her what happened, she just sat there and patted her foot. And then she said, "You know what?" And I said, "What?" And Mrs. Harris said, "The bishop needs just such a rain barrel in the churchyard to give some members I know what little Melvin got." And then Mrs. Harris said, "Let's talk about fishing." And we did. Thank God for fishing. Thank God for Mrs. Harris. And God bless poor little Melvin. Amen. I've got some extra copies of that if anybody wants some when we're done. I'd like to begin with a prayer, if we could. Lord Christ, it is into your name that we are baptized, and by the power of the Holy Spirit, we are sent into our lives to do that mission with which you gift us. We ask that in this hour you would bring home to us an even clearer sense of what it means to be part of your family, given this identity as one of your children, preserved and kept and covered in this covenant of baptism, that we might know who we are and find protection against our shame. In your name we pray. Amen. I'd like to take a few minutes right up front here this morning just to do some review for a couple of reasons. Not everybody, I'm sure, has been part of the two prior sessions when we talked about a psychology of shame and a theology of shame. So this might be a chance just to toss out some things that you remember and can bring some other folks in on the discussion. I'm also kind of interested and curious to know, out of the last two sessions from Monday and yesterday, what has stayed with you? It's good feedback for me to know kind of what sticks and what doesn't stick. Teaching tends to be a rather unscientific thing, you know, like you sort of throw it up against the wall and see what sticks, and then the next time you come back, you know what really resonates with people. If you would, just toss out some things that have stayed with you out of the last couple days, and as you've thought about this issue of shame, where do you find yourself this morning? And if you, it helps if you raise your hand. Go ahead.
I was at the first session, and I think I got a clearer idea of the difference between guilt and shame. I never remember.
Go ahead for that.
I remember guilt is something you do, and shame is more in relationship to what you are.
Yeah. I'm glad that stayed with you. We'll talk a little more about that today. It's a helpful distinction. Yeah. Somebody else, Mike or Bill?
I was only at the first session, but...
where were you yesterday?
Well, I have to choose between all the things. I'm ashamed to say I would not.
No, that's guilt.
Anyway, I discovered that I guess my definition of shame was rather limited, because I never read much about it or thought much about it, actually. And... you certainly expanded, it has quite a breadth of a variety of meanings.
Did it make sense? Because, I mean, you're certainly under no obligation to buy my explanations. Did it fit with your experience? Yeah, I know.
I guess I always thought of shame as something very traumatic and major. Mm-hmm. And the definitions that you laid out were, I could understand, where yes, you can interpret as shame, what I used to call embarrassment, mm-hmm. or... committing a faux pas, or these kinds of, I had different terms on it. I didn't see it in the same kind of depth.
Yeah.
I was surprised to find that shame is used so often in the Bible, in your discussions.
It's really instructive. Just pick up a concordance sometime and look up shame and ashamed, and it's pretty interesting. Yeah. Somebody else back here.
I'm still a little confused on the difference between shame and embarrassment.
Yeah, I am too. there certainly are gradations of these affects, these emotions. And I don't think it's wrong to say, as Bill and I talked about the other day, that embarrassment is somewhat less penetrating. But it's on a grid that certainly points toward this deeper issue of shame. And it's also very idiosyncratic to who we each are as people. What for one person is a slight experience of embarrassment, for another person maybe a deep experience of shame. I was mentioning to someone yesterday that this issue of embarrassment, interestingly, in the 19th century, partly out of some work I think that Darwin had done, scientists or observers of human beings, anthropologists, began to conclude that the ability to blush was something peculiar to human beings, that animals did not do this rush of blood to your face, and the embarrassment that you feel. It's a desire, in a sense, to cover yourself. It's just a visceral thing that happens. Very interestingly, one of the things that began to, this is sad but interesting, one of the things that began to turn many people's opinion around about the slavery issue relating to black Africans coming to the United States was that scientists discovered that black people did in fact blush, although not as visible nearly, but that blood did come to their face in a moment of embarrassment. As I say, it's sad, but for some people this was very convincing, that these were in fact human beings. Needing to be treated as such. It is sad. But so that issue of embarrassment comes into play in rather interesting ways, I guess. But, yeah, Bill.
I suppose that would depend on your partly on your upbringing. If you have someone who's always saying to you, you should be ashamed of yourself, I suppose you develop a deeper sense of shame and would react more frequently.
That's right. How intact or shaky your identity, your ego is, has a lot to do with how receptive you are in those moments, and it's partly what we're going to get into today, is how to fortify that. Yeah.
Well, I was impressed that it's possible for us to lay shame on people with our insensitivity. yeah. and not listening to them.
Yeah. Yeah, please.
I just happen to...
Go ahead.
I just happen to think of one thing that I always get hung up with, and that is, what is appropriate? And that leads to embarrassment sometimes. And I have a person that last time starts down here, and I just have to say it, you know. And usually it's couched in a humorous form. And sometimes it's very out of place. And then I get embarrassed. Yeah. Or especially if my wife says to
Yeah.
But I never have figured out what is appropriate.
And I think, you know, in a world where we live with sin and where relationships are broken or tentative, that's one of the reasons why it's not always clear what is appropriate. We don't live in perfect community. It's not clear exactly always how to relate to people. And so shame is forever a possibility. It's going to happen because of that uncertainty about how to relate and, you know, where are the appropriate boundaries and limitations and so forth. Yeah, please.
Well, something that is somewhat bothering me is that are we all born with shame? That it's like an original sin that is placed upon us, and how we deal with that, either by our upbringing or teaching or our makeup, more shame would come out or more shame would be experienced by myself versus another person.
See, I would say yes, that there is for all of us that propensity to experience shame. And the reason being that we are people created for relationship, and in a fallen world, relationships are not perfectly kept in order, and that when we experience the breakdown of those relationships, and we've talked several ways about the relational nature of shame, when I extend myself to someone and that is not reciprocated, or I place my trust inappropriately in someone or something that cannot really bear the weight of my trust, that comes back to me as being exposed and I feel the shame. I think it's inevitable. It's going to come to us one way or the other. The question is, and the question really that I want to deal with today is, then where is the hope? I mean, what can we do to help fortify each other against this toxic sense of shame that really can be so crippling? We will all experience some shame. And there's a whole other issue here that we haven't even gotten into, and I'm not even going to get into it today, but the issue of shame, shamelessness, and shame as a sense of modesty and discretion, you see, it unfolds into another realm yet. There is a sense in which some shame is helpful and healthy in terms of discretion, checking me and keeping me aware and alert, sensitive to others. What we've been talking about, what I'm really dealing with today, is this, what Bradshaw calls the toxic shame that can be so crippling and cut us off from other people. Shame, in a sense of discretion and modesty, is helpful because it adds to, it contributes something to relationships. It keeps us sensitive to other people. But I'm not going to try to get into all of that. That's a whole another session, I suppose. Well, you ready to jump in a little bit here with the baptism issue? Let me share a little bit of reflection from the Apostle Paul in Romans. I've shared part of this before already. This is Romans chapter 10. The scripture says, "No one who believes in him," that is Jesus, "will be put to shame. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. The same Lord is Lord of all, bestows his riches upon all who call upon him. For everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. But how are people to call upon him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without a preacher? And how can people preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel, for Isaiah says, 'Lord, who has believed what has been heard from us?' So faith comes from what is heard, and what is heard comes by the preaching of Christ." We'll unfold that as we go along this morning. I picked up this idea of an antidote I'm kind of embarrassed to say, actually, from the Indiana Jones movie, the second one, I think, the Temple of Doom. You may remember that opening scene. He's in this nightclub in Shanghai, I think, and he's sitting across the table from this notorious gangster, Lao Che, his arch enemy adversary. And somehow in the process, Lao Che slips him this deadly poison into his drink, and unknowns to him, he drinks it, and all of a sudden he realizes he's going to become deathly ill. But then his arch enemy produces this little vial, and in this vial is the antidote that can save him from this toxic substance which he's consumed. And you may remember they get into a big fight, and the little vial is rolling all over the floor, and somehow there's a, you know, there was an exchange. Jones has this priceless diamond, and he's to give that over if he wants the antidote, and however, you know. Of course, in the nick of time, you know, it all works out. He grabs and drinks the stuff, and he's saved. Well, I mean, it would be nice, wouldn't it, if for all of life's deadly ills and pains, there were some little antidote that you could pick up and drink and sort of simply save yourself from all that. Well, I certainly don't mean to say that there is any simple antidote for shame. But I do want to suggest that baptism, in a sense, is an antidote for this vexing problem of shame. It at least begins to point us in the right direction, I think, in terms of establishing an identity of who we are, whose we are, and what our purpose in life is really all about. One of the earliest theologians to reflect on shame was Augustine. And there are a couple places in his book of Confessions. Any of you read this, by the way, acquainted with this? You may know that the Confessions are not Augustine's litany of every juicy thing he ever did in his life. It's really more of a dialogue with God in which he does confess some of his misgivings about all that he's been and done. You may know that Augustine, for the first part of his life, led a pretty raucous youth, and only later was he converted to Christianity in a full sense. I want to share a little snippet here as he talks about a relationship that he had with his friend. He does not use here the word shame, although that does appear other places in the confession. But listen to how he describes the feelings here and see if it resonates with anything we've talked about in the last couple of days. Again, he's writing this to God as a sort of journal or prayer to God. During those years when I first began to teach in Tagaste, my native town, I had found a very dear friend. We were both the same age, both together in the heyday of youth, and both absorbed in the same interests. We had grown up together as boys, gone to school together, and played together. As a boy, he had never held firmly or deeply to the true faith, and I had drawn him away from it to believe in the same superstitious, soul-destroying fallacies which brought my mother to tears over me. Now, as a man, he was my companion in error, and I was utterly lost without him. My friend fell gravely ill of a fever. His senses were numbed as he lingered in the sweat of death, and when all hope of saving him was lost, he was baptized as he lay unconscious. I cared nothing for this because I chose to believe that his soul would retain what it had learnt from me, no matter what was done to his body when it was deprived of sense. But no such thing happened. New life came into him, and he recovered. And as soon as I could talk to him, which was as soon as he could talk to me, for I never left his side since we were so dependent on each other, I tried to chaff him about his baptism, thinking that he too would make fun of it, since he had received it when he was quite incapable of thought or feeling. But by this time, he had been told of it. He looked at me in horror as though I were an enemy, and in a strange, newfound attitude of self-reliance, he warned me that if I wished to be his friend, I must never speak to him like that again. I was astonished and confused, But I did not tell him what I felt, hoping that when he was better and had recovered his strength, he would be in a condition to listen to what I had to say. But he was rescued from my folly and taken into your safekeeping for my later consolation. For a few days after this, while I was away from him, the fever returned and he died. My heart grew somber with grief, and wherever I looked, I saw only death. My own country became a torment, and my own home a grotesque abode of misery. All that we had done together was now a grim ordeal without him. My eyes searched everywhere for him, but he was not there to be seen. I hated all the places we had known together, because he was not in them, and they could no longer whisper to me, "Here he comes," as they would have done had he been alive, but absent for a while. I had become a puzzle to myself, asking my soul again and again, "Why are you downcast? Why do you distress me?" But my soul had no answer to give. If I said, "Wait for God's help," she did not obey. And in this she was right, because to her, the well-loved man whom she had lost was better and more real than the shadowy being in whom I would have her trust. Tears alone were sweet to me, for in my heart's desire they had taken the place of my friend. Did you pick up anything in Augustine's emotional content there that resonates with what we've been talking about in terms of shame? Yeah, he used that word confusion, didn't he?
He's looking back at it in terms of the friend having died, and really his last contact with the friend was an argument about... He tried to make fun of the baptism, wanted his friends to join in. His friend didn't, and confused him and astonished, surprised him. And so I expect he feels remorse as well.
Yeah.
He could control his friend. Mm. He could no longer control his friend.
Yeah. And nor himself, now, apparently, his own feelings about this. Yeah. Yeah, the word confusion is interesting, how he drops it in there. And I think also his comments about death. He says, you know, my own life had become to me now, what did he say, morose or something. But he's confronted with his own mortality, which as we talked a little about yesterday, in the sense of shame coming to us perhaps as the law, brings us in touch with that. And here Augustine has this experience of, you know, chiding his friend, making fun of him, really. Someone who he loved very much, who he had obviously invested a great deal in. And then the relationship is cut off. And I think it's safe to say that leaves him with a sense of shame. That's reading a little bit into it, too, because of some other episodes in the Confessions. His episode of stealing the pears from his neighbor's tree and so forth, where he more overtly talks about his sense of shame about that. But he's left quite with a question, I think, of, you know, who am I? What kind of a person am I that I would do this? Not just what have I done, but who am I that I would do this? Yeah.
Do you think he knew he was ashamed? He felt such sadness and remorse and everything. Do you think he realized that he was ashamed of what he had done, or was he just so terribly sad over what he had?
Well, as we said, you may remember from when we talked about a psychology of shame, that one of the difficult things about shame is that it's hard to talk about. We talk about other descriptions for it. It is, as Robert Caron said, shame is melodramatic, and that, I mean, it is dramatic, and it makes it hard to talk about. So, that's a hard question to answer. You know, would the person in that situation hang that tag on it? I don't know, but it's obvious he knew that he hurt somehow very deeply.
I don't think many people.
Yeah.
You know, you talk to many people who have survived drowning, and they'll tell you that they don't think they were drowning at the time. They knew they were in trouble, but they didn't pin "I'm drowning" on it. And I think to apply here, you may not have pinned "I'm ashamed" or "I'm shameful" here.
Do you see that as a bit of... person is distancing themselves from really what a close brush with death they actually did have, so that later they're saying, well, it wasn't, you know, it was a little awkward perhaps, but you know, not all that bad. Could that be the case? I mean, it's hard to go back to a really dire moment in our experience and bring it back to share with people. It's just very hard to do that. I think we have to accept that. And that's one of the reasons why shame is so potent and yet so difficult to deal with, because even the reintroducing of the issue produces more shame, and then you feel some shame about being ashamed, and it can become a vicious cycle. Well, this sort of toxic shame. Another little vignette, perhaps. I forget where I read this, but child in early grades in school, perhaps in art class, you know, they're all doing their paintings or drawings or whatever, and the teacher then wants to hang them all up around the room so that all the parents can see them when they come in on Parents' Day or whatever. And then some really insensitive teacher, or perhaps just a teacher on a bad day who's not thinking, says something like, "Oh, Susie, Johnny, I do wish you pay more attention. You know, how come your drawing can't be as nice as so-and-so's?" I mean, we probably all even said things like that. But you begin to get a sense of how small that can make people feel. And if this is a child who does not have a particularly strong sense of self, does not have a good sense of relationship with parents and other adults, that can be just like a blunt instrument, he's jabbed in there, and a difficult, difficult wound to try to heal. So we're looking for some sort of antidote here. What can begin to remedy that kind of a situation? Well, we're going to turn to Luther for a moment and his famous "Nevertheless," he said. If you know anything at all about Luther's life, you know that he struggled mightily to come to terms with who he was. I think we talked a bit about this yesterday. It was not for Luther just an issue of what can I do, although he certainly pursued that path. His spiritual discontent, as he initially experienced it, he thought there must be something he had done wrong and needed to do right in order to rectify this. And so, as you know, he confessed and confessed and confessed and confessed, and poor Staupitz, who heard his confessions, practically got his ears talked off, because Luther would just rack his brain to come up with every last little thing. And Staupitz finally had to say, go away until you've really done something interesting. don't bother me with all this trivial stuff. But Luther was so intent on trying to find a sense of peace and right relationship with God. Well, in order to really understand why that's so, we need maybe a little short course in baptism, or in the sacraments in general, in Luther's day. The theology that Luther learned and absorbed from his teachers was called Scholasticism, although there were several schools of thought within Scholasticism, but this scholastic theology was certainly carrying the day in the late Middle Ages when Luther lived. And that way of thinking looked at the human predicament this way, that the basic problem people faced was concupiscence. Let's see if I can spell that right. Concupiscence. Is that right? I hope. Whoops, there's another C.
There's a C, yeah.
C-E-N-C-E. Which meant that you were born with this original sin that was just pointing you in the direction of doing bad things. You were concupiscent. Original sin had tainted you so that you could not really do what was right. So you needed, right at the beginning of life, something that could make an impact on this concupiscent nature. And so the first sacrament that the church offered was baptism, which the theology of Luther's day taught, almost in a kind of magical way, altered your character. It affected this concupiscent nature and made you less likely to sin. Now, it didn't totally remove all possibility of sin, but fortified with that, you were much less likely to do wrong. Scholasticism allowed, there was still a little flickering flame of concupiscence that as various temptations came your way throughout life, could certainly fan that flame into a raging fire. And therefore, at each crucial moment of life, you would need additional sacramental help in order to keep that whatever small amount of concupiscence was left in check. Therefore, the very elaborate scheme of the sacramental system of the Middle Ages, which, as you know, may know, there were seven. Let's see if we can remember what they were.
At least seven.
Yeah, at least, maybe depending on how you count them, but we'll go for that. What were the sacraments? Okay, start with baptism.
Communion.
Baptism, Eucharist.
Marriage.
You can't write fast enough. Marriage, okay.
Ordination, or confirmation.
Okay, confirmation, I'll abbreviate.
Ordination.
Unction. What is unction?
Last rites.
Yeah, last rites. 3, 4, 5, 6, what did we forget?
Confession,
penance, yeah. There you have it. A sacrament for every moment of need. Yeah. Now, I want to contend that the really interesting, curious thing about this system is that it develops a theological anthropology, or a theological way of viewing the human problem, what makes human beings tick, in terms of guilt. The problem is that you will have a propensity to do wrong. Therefore, at the very beginning, your character must be changed somehow to eradicate as much of this concupiscent nature as possible. But because you probably can't do that absolutely, then at each step of the way, you can get a new infusion of grace to help you in your moment of need. So that, you know, Eucharist is there at worship whenever you need it. In your married life, you get sent off with grace of God. You are confirmed into a fuller life in the church, additional grace to help you. If you really want to be as sure as possible of your salvation, then seek ordination. For those who renounce the world and enter that life, it was believed that you got a sort of extra break out of that. And even better if you then entered the monastery, which of course was Luther's belief that by, as Roland Baton says it, he took the haven of the cowl. He thought that by putting on the cowl of the monk, he got an extra chance to experience even more grace. Unction, of course, at the last moment, you know, to cover anything else that hadn't been covered, you would receive last rites, one last shot of grace. And then, of course, the doing of penance connected with confession. Again, it was very important that you do penance. And remember what we said, guilt is breaking rules, and then you are forgiven and the need for restoration in response to that. I think what Luther did by reforming the church and its theology was to really develop a different way of looking at human beings that said the fundamental problem is not guilt in the sense of doing what is wrong, but rather shame in the sense of being out of right relationship. Therefore, Luther, when he realized that one could be both justified and sinful at the same time, that being justified did not mean that you stopped sinning, but that even as you committed these transgressions, you could still be in an ongoing right relationship with God, he began to realize that when you came to baptism was not giving you some sort of magical infusion of grace that changed your character. It was rather reestablishing a relationship with God, on which you could depend for the rest of your life. Every day, as he said, you must go back to the waters of your baptism, walking wet in those waters and being drowned again. How was it he said? Baptism eradicates or drowns the old Adam, but the old Adam is a pretty good swimmer, so you need daily to experience this. In other words, Luther, in his baptismal theology, addressed baptism not just to misdeeds, but to mistrust. And again, if you read in the Large Catechism, I think one of the clearest and best things that Luther ever wrote, his explanation to the first commandment, where he asked the question, you know, what is it to have a God? And he says, a God is simply that in which you trust and to which you turn in every time of need. He really is amazingly consistent how he works out a theology that is based on promises and trusting promises, which of course has everything to do with relationship. Which promises are you going to trust in this life? That's the central question for any human being. Again, it's not a question of do we believe in God, but what kind of a God do we believe in? It's not just do we trust, but what is it that we do trust? So, well, I should say too, I don't think, you read Luther, I don't know as he has even half a dozen passages in all 50-some volumes of Luther's works where you'll find the word shame. And he certainly didn't have all of the psychological equipment that we have today to define shame the way that we've been talking about it. Well, we can't blame him for that. That's not his problem. It's up to us, I think, to work with his theology to see whether he did have some deep theological insights that today's human sciences, you know, can help us sort out. And I would very strongly contend that he did reframe the human predicament along the lines of what we have been talking about much more as shame than guilt. Yeah, Bill.
Do you think he was also aware that he was really shifting the whole focus
of
the faith from a control system by an institution to a totally free reliance upon God without the need for institutional
integration? Absolutely.
Did he know he was doing that, or do you think it just happened in the process?
No, I think he was aware, he became aware, I think, that yes, that there was no turning back from what he was proposing, that this was going to be a fundamentally different way of looking at the sacraments. Well, in fact, as you know, Luther then began to pare back on the number of things that were truly sacraments here, settled in for a while with three sacraments, baptism, Eucharist, and confession. Then a little farther down the line came to the conclusion that really, baptism was the sacrament of confession. And what you were doing when you were coming to confession and doing penance was nothing different from, but simply an extension of, the experience of baptism, this daily dying and rising. So he concluded it was not necessary, it was redundant to have confession as a third sacrament.
But he kept it in the small catechism, didn't he?
Yeah, for a time it appears, and then I think by about the middle of the 1520s you find that he intentionally addresses that issue, and off the top of my head I can't tell you which writing on baptism that is, but there is a point at which he rather intentionally says we ought to see baptism in this more full sense, and therefore, you know, while confession is extremely important, we won't consider it as a sacrament. It's been an unfortunate point, I think, in the Lutheran experience, that because of that, we have come very much to devalue personal confession and penance. Luther never, ever intended that we stop that practice. Yet, if I ask for a show of hands, I bet we would hardly find one person here who in their congregation still has anything like a regular experience of even the possibility of personal confession doing a penance.
Is there anybody? Though, isn't it?
How's that?
There is a service available.
Yeah, there certainly is. You can use the LBW right, or you know, a number of things,
including sharing with another person.
He's talking about a regular basis.
Could be.
On a weekly or
well, even the, you know, I mean, have any of us ever gone to the pastor or even just a Christian friend to say, I need to confess, I need you to hear my confession, I need for you to pronounce forgiveness and assist me in the doing of penance, you know, as that may be appropriate in this case. You know, it's curious that to me that the 12-step programs like AA pay more attention to that with the step where you are assigned the task of, you know, as much restitution for the wrongs you've done as is reasonably possible, to the extent at least that you don't have an adverse effect on other people's lives. That's a very powerful step, I think, in people's journey of recovery. And it's rather sad that we've lost that. I would say in terms of shame, especially because that moment of confession and forgiveness is a place where you can begin to rebuild this, what we've talked about as the interpersonal bridge, the restoration of relationship. Someone to acknowledge your brokenness, your fallenness, your shame, the pain that you feel about being out of relationship and so forth, and to remind you, nevertheless, you are baptized, you have the permission and the confidence and the courage and the blessing to go on. So,
Brad, what if you aren't baptized?
Ask that.
I'm just thinking, right. You know, in the kind of society,
sure. Even,
majority of people well, aren't, and they still go through the 12-step program, and, mm-hmm. and they do come to pastors.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you my personal answer to that. I mean, I can't say this is totally inclusive, but I would not say that you are not a child of God if you are not baptized. On the other hand, if you have a sense of what baptism offers and provides, why would you not want to be baptized is always a question to be raised. And why would we not want to encourage others to be baptized, not in a coercive, you know, let's go through the village and jerk everyone out of their hut and have them be baptized, as some, you know, missionaries will want to do. Although, interestingly, the church never said those baptisms were invalid, although perhaps unfortunate. I would simply say, if this is available to us as a resource, why would we not want to embrace it?
That would have to come after some kind of announcement to the person. I mean, what do you announce to the person who isn't baptized? That they are a child of God, that they are accepted, and that therefore it's a good idea to get baptized. Like, what do you say to the secular person who, you know, maybe doesn't feel the need for institutionalized religion and sees baptism as an institutional expression, but yet you want to say the same thing we're saying about baptism?
This is good. You're right. Oh. See, we're back to where we began yesterday, talking about theological method. Now the question is, how does one relate one's human experience to the Christian message, the content of our theology? How do we bring this good news of Jesus Christ available in and through baptism to a person's situation? Well, I would say you can start at either end. You can start with proclamation of good news, possibly. But that's not a, that proclamation has not really done its work unless it arouses in us some realization of our own situation, our fallenness, our need for restoration. Or perhaps you can start at the other end. Perhaps the person comes already with an awareness that somehow things are not right, you know, and we may need to help them clarify just what that is that is their experience. I mean, that, you know, there can be neurotic guilt and so forth that really is excessive, and that needs to be sometimes clarified. And then you move from their situation to what the message has to offer. And each kind of need to go back and forth to clarify the other. I think that's a question of theological method. I mean, a good one. Where do you start? And I would say you can start at either end of the street as long as you keep a two-way street going. See, in some theologies that say the method is really simply to apply the message to the situation, then you don't really have to take people's unique individual pains and hurts and lives very seriously. You just come and say, here's the message, let it apply to you, be saved, that's it, okay. I think that just does not take each of us seriously enough as, you know, as the human beings that we are. I don't know, is that helpful? Or?
Yeah, I had a friend in the seminary with a deep sense of shame, and he wanted to use the rituals of the church, so he frequently went for Eucharist. He reminded himself of his baptism. We would do private confession, penance. It didn't do it for him, no. He needed something beyond formal.
Was shame
now
his...
I'm aware that it was the working of the Spirit, and that doesn't happen.
Was,
it happens, it doesn't always happen in the Eucharist. Or in the
Was shame his own self-description? Or are you saying that kind of looking back and knowing what you know, you would characterize it?
Yeah, he was ashamed.
Did he say that about himself?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And his experience seemed to fit with kind of how we've been talking about shame?
But then wouldn't part of that be he just simply didn't believe? I don't mean believe in Christ. I mean believe in the power of baptism, or believe really that his...
That was the odd thing. He was trying hard to believe it.
and more on that in just a second. But
on an intellectual basis.
Yeah, this is where we need to be really careful, you see, because if we set up the criteria of our right relationship with God as being my power to believe and trust, back on pretty shaky ground again, you see. When it comes to this issue of trust, see, the question usually arises, well, I mean, aren't you just suggesting then that this is one more work that you have to do? You have to trust God. Now, I'm simply saying that if you are a human being, then you will trust something. I mean, trusting comes with the equipment of being human like breathing does, I think. I mean, in a psychological sense anyway. I mean, you don't have a choice whether to breathe or not breathe. If you're human, you will breathe. And if you don't breathe, you will die. I think psychologically you can say, in order to just be a person, you have to trust something. I mean, just call that a God-given trait if you want. The only question is, where does the trust get directed? So, please, back here and then up here.
You mentioned that if we understood the advantages of baptism, are you including, every type, every form? For example, if there's lots of different ideas people have of what constitutes baptism, mm-hmm. even 12-year-old, immersion, so on. You would put them all on the same level? For example, if a person is baptized, say, as an infant,
mm-hmm.
And they were never aware of it, what effect does this have on them?
Yeah.
You're down to saying it was merely, as, like you mentioned before, a magic
right.
formula.
Well, let me move on to this next point. I hope that can answer what you're saying. Fair enough? I guess basically I would say yes. All forms are included here. I mean, every form that the Christian tradition has recognized as valid, whether that be immersion, sprinkling, pouring, at whatever age, as long as it's,
But if a person isn't aware of that, it doesn't have that effect on his life and relationship to God.
Well, good point.
Because of the people surrounding you in the church that where it's done. I mean, there, it's a relationship thing again. You are growing up as a child and you learn that you have been baptized, and that because of that you are in a church and you are a member, and or you are a child of God in a special relationship with God.
Your parents have a civil responsibility.
Yeah. Let's go back to the Apostle Paul for a second, if I can. And he asks in this passage I read from Romans, how are people to call upon him in whom they have not believed, and how are they to believe in him whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without a preacher? And how can people preach unless they are sent? I think, as is being suggested, we are the answers to those questions. And as I suggest up here, this is parents, and maybe others too, but parents as preachers. When parents bring infants for baptism, then one of the things which they are obligating themselves to and making themselves available for is a lifelong vocation of communicating the good news. The reinforcement of this happening in baptism. Yes,
it's
true.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah, what if you're baptized and you have some other parents and you're taken away in your whole life, you never know you're baptized. Does it make any difference?
Yeah, I think it does make a big difference. It does not invalidate your baptism, certainly. Mm-hmm. But the extent to which your baptism is available to you as a resource, you know, for spiritual edification, I think it makes a huge difference. And that's
if you were
why
ever aware of it, you wouldn't
what if you
be
never
available
knew
to
you?
You
were baptized?
Yeah, I think obviously then there's work to be done. Bill?
I've had situations where the person comes not sure if they've been baptized or not, so they're going to check with their mother, and they find out from mom, well, she can't remember either whether they were or weren't, and so they're saying, well, to make sure, we baptize them. Now, what would you all do in that situation?
Should we call those double
dipping? there's not a certain... he thought he was because he remembers quite a sudden fall. Anyway, those kinds of situations are sort of interesting because then you do become the preacher. And I always err on the side of if the person doesn't, you know, has some feeling that maybe they weren't and there's no proof there, then go ahead and do it. To make sure that they're aware of it for the rest of their life, even if they haven't been in the first part of life.
Then if your name is already in the book of heaven, God can just put an exclamation.
Put two times. The other interesting situation, I think, is with Mormon baptisms, because if you explore with a Mormon what they think about their baptism, if they become Lutheran, frequently they think it's a Christian baptism. And the Mormons do baptize in the name of the Father, and Son, and the Holy Spirit. So.
There's another interesting area that a lot of you probably not really know, you think about, is there's thousands of people in your cities all over the world called Salvation Army soldiers who have never been baptized and never will, and they consciously do not become baptized. And of course, a lot of us, I think they are doing good work and are Christians and so forth, but I've often wondered about that because I spent my first 20 years in that group. And
don't they believe in baptism of the Spirit, though?
Yes.
Yeah, which they equate with our baptism.
Yeah, that's true.
Discussions of baptism. It just doesn't have any water with it.
Okay.
It's a waterless baptism.
It's the same with Quakers. Does that make it any less valid?
Yeah.
We'll leave that up to our pastor.
Let's go back. Please.
Well, I've known people, for example, who have been baptized 2 or 3 times because they get in different congregations or so, and they figure, well, that one didn't quite take, so I'm going to get baptized in this method or this procedure.
And I want to say, shame on the clergy who let that happen, really. That's a absolutely enfeebled understanding of the Christian tradition, I'm going to bash some people here, but that is a...
Catholics do it.
Huh?
Catholic priests do it.
Whoever, I'll lay the blame equally, but it's a, you know, it's often in this day and age simply a desire to bring members into the church and do whatever it takes, and I think we have an obligation, and I've had to do this myself, and it's rather difficult and trying when someone comes and says I want to be baptized, you know, and they inquire, well, so you weren't baptized then, and or they're like, well, yeah, you know, I was as an infant, but it doesn't make any sense. And then to have to painfully walk that through with people as to what that means and why it would be inappropriate to re-baptize. I mean, if baptism is death and resurrection, you can only die once. You know, I mean, in that sense, you can only die once. It would be redundant, and there's no purpose in that. But to then try to help people understand what has happened. That's why I think this vocation of being the proclaimers must follow in the wake of the actual baptizing, the actual baptismal activity. It's very important and very powerful. We're almost out of time. I want to go back and pick up a comment here from that article I mentioned the other day by Robert Caron on shame. I mean, this is interesting because here's just a person of the popular culture, not a theologian or explicitly a Christian person. But he writes in this article, nothing apparently defends against the internal ravages of shame more than the security gained from parental love. Now, if you think about that in terms of A, all the things we've talked about as parents needing to reinforce the baptismal meaning and message, but B, what that means in terms of God as parent and the relationship we have with God as mother and or father, I mean, filling a multidimensional role there, that speaks volumes, I think. I think that means for parents, you know, tell your children the story of their baptismal day as often and as much as you tell them the story of their birthday. Today is my birthday, by the way. 37 years into the journey. Huh?
You don't look 40.
You don't look 55. Pretty amazing. We all do. I know the story, you know, about how at 7 o'clock in the morning, after my father had already gone to work and my aunt had come from Iowa to be with my mother, and my mother went into labor and off they went, and I was born rather quickly, and my father didn't quite arrive in time, but got there shortly after. I mean, we all know the story. Have you seen the movie City Slickers? Any of you?
Yeah.
Remember that scene at the beginning? It's his birthday, and his mother calls up and goes through what has obviously become a yearly ritual about, you know, your father and I were driving down the freeway.
I heard the story.
And he lip syncs the whole thing because he's heard it so often. Well, why can't we tell children the story of their baptismal day? You know, we dressed you in such and such an outfit, and it was this kind of day, and we took you to church, and so-and-so was there, and the preacher did and said this. And when we had Martin baptized last January, one of the guys in my congregation was nice enough to make a videotape of the service, but he also went around on the patio before church and just got little interviews with people, you know, how are you doing today, why did you come, did you know that Martin's being baptized, you know, and then afterwards he recorded some other things, what did you think of this experience, really interesting, well that's something we can show to Martin and can help reinforce the event for him. I think it's all very important. Yeah.
Yeah, this is very important. We did this with our kids, and it's amazing how that lasts. Because our oldest son now is about 20. We used to have baptism parties for them.
Yeah.
I think with gifts and clowns and neighborhood kids and everything else. But our one son, who's 25, has been on quite a spiritual search. The last time we spoke about his spirituality, he defined himself as a Christian Buddhist. And I said, how does this work out? He said, well, I like meditation, and I get to read Zen. He said, but I'm aware that I'm a baptized Christian. So he's somehow at this point in life kind of connected the two, but he doesn't lose the baptized Christian part, which is sort of an important part of his journey. I think that's a result of reminding him.
We have two adopted kids. One was baptized before we got her. She's a Lutheran pastor now. And the other one was baptized when we were there. And he doesn't want anything to do with the church. How do you explain that?
I don't know. Well, let me close with the final paragraph of this article from Robert Caron, which is as religious as he gets, and I think rather profound. In medieval Christendom, the belief that all people were sinners, that all were unworthy, used this sense of universal defect to bind the community, to maintain a spiritual focus, and perhaps, incidentally, to drain off some shame that might otherwise have become individual and narcissistic. From our distant perspective in a diametrically different world, we can easily imagine how comforting it might have been to know that one was not alone in one's flaws and vulnerabilities, to feel assured of one's place despite everything, to be confident that all were equal in God's eyes. I think there's there a kind of longing for what, in fact, you know, the Christian message does make available. That need not be just a kind of wistful longing, but there really can be in Christian community fulfillment for that sort of desire. The knowledge that we do stand together in right relationship with God, that baptism is a daily part of our lives to provide us with an identity that covers us in our exposure. That's Pauline language about putting on Christ in baptism. That when shame is there to question or even destroy our identity, baptism tells us who we are, whose we are, and that if we hear the shame as law, as a no, then baptism is there as a gospel word, as a yes, as permission to go forward.